happy to be here. This is the second time the Nevada Court of Appeals has denied the law school for this same room last year in November. It's a definite good feeling back here today. Assisted by Judge Evans over here to my right, and Judge McCown here to my left. And we have a surprise on the next case, which I'll explain later. There was a request from the local newspaper, RJ, to have a photographer here today for the proceedings. And our court clerk, Tom Harris, said, check with counsel, is there any objection to having that proceedings photographed? So we have Mr. Haight and Mr. Wall representing the parties here today. I hope you're excited to be here too. It's not very often that the oral arguments are held in a remote location. Although for our court, we enjoy it fairly frequently. So we have two very interesting cases on today, both civil cases. The first one is case 65556, Sweet versus Harris, Las Vegas. And as I mentioned, we have Mr. Haight here for the appellant, Mr. Wall for the respondent. So 15 minutes up per side. The appellant can reserve time for rebuttal if so desired. And also, counsel, when we're done with the second argument, we will be taking questions from the students or the audience. And we found in the past that lawyers can sometimes answer the questions better than we can. So if you want to stay, you're welcome to do so, to be part of this educational process here at Boyd. But if you've got other commitments, feel free to leave. So, Christopher, do you have any introductory comments before we start?
I'm just very honored to be here again. Thank you for having us, Boyd. I am an alumni of UNLV, not Boyd, older than that. But it's great to be back on campus and to see familiar faces. So we're hoping to inspire people just like when I was inspired as a student.
To thank everybody for accommodating us. I know whenever we come out here, it's in the faculty has put some time to accommodate us, and we would appreciate that. I also know that the members probably not ideal for the students. Everybody's probably gearing up for exams and all that kind of good stuff. But for those of you here, we really do appreciate it and hope that you learn something from what you're about to see.
Thank you. I hope some of the students took a look at the pleadings that were filed in this case. These cases get caught recently all over the bottom. If not that, at least the summary we put out. Right, Mr. Haight, I'd like to start.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Donald Haight, appearing on behalf of Plaintiff Tommy Sweet. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. There are three different issues presently before this court and two separate appeals. In case number 65556, the first appeal, there is an appeal of the jury verdict and the judgment that is entered thereon. There's an appeal of the denial of the motion for new trial. These two issues are closely intertwined in that the same reasons that were put forward to reverse the jury verdict are the same reasons that were put forward to grant new trial. So those two different issues are fairly easy to resolve together. The second appeal in case number 69453, which was filed after the first appeal was finished, or was before this, the court, is an appeal for the denial of a motion to set aside the judgment based upon the fraud of the court. Because of the severe time limitations that I am under, I can only deal with the major issues before this court. And Sweet will rely on her briefs to support the other arguments made on her behalf. Therefore, I would request that failure to address any issue in oral argument should not be construed as a waiver of that issue before the court. This case involves trial by ambush, discovery abuses, and attorney misconduct. This case presents the court with an opportunity to set forth clear guidelines to the bar regarding the discovery obligations of all attorneys. NRCP Rule 1 provides that the rules of civil procedure shall be construed to secure just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. The ADA Division for Public Education has set forth in its website, discovery enables the parties to know before trial begins what evidence may be presented. It's designed to prevent trial by ambush, where one side doesn't learn of the other side's evidence or witnesses until trial, where there is no time to obtain answering evidence. Unfortunately, discovery in Nevada has become a game of clever lawyering on both the plaintiffs and the defense side. Discovery is not seen as an obligation to provide full and complete information for opposing counsel. Instead, it is viewed as a game in which counsel try to hide as much evidence as possible. Answers to interrogatories and responses to requests for produce come now with a preamble of objections. They're making objections before they even see the questions.
Why didn't you go to the discovery commissioner on that?
We didn't go to the discovery commissioner because we had no information that would lead us to believe that this answer was incomplete. As you will see later in my argument, the issue of using these chemical compounds for slip resistance on the marble floors was something that was never brought forward in an answer to the interrogatory or in a person most knowledgeable deposition. Instead, what we received were instructions on how to clean and polish their floors. The plaintiff was not interested in how Kyle Harris cleaned and polished their floors. We wanted to know what safety measures were taken by Harris to protect his patients. And, it's hard to know that something is being withheld when it's being withheld.
It wasn't really the polish, though. That was that caused her to slip, to spill, possibly her ear. And they lifted up her head. Her whole head was wet. Her husband said the head was wet.
That's true. The spill caused her to slip. However, Harris, an open argument, contended we use reasonable care because we applied a polish to the floor that has slip-resistant characteristics, and basically we've done everything we can to protect our patients. So the polish became a huge issue in the case regarding the reasonableness and the standard of care. Essentially what happens now is that each individual interrogatory request to produce is met with an objection. Counsel view these objections as a license to provide incomplete discovery responses. They figure that, well, I objected to the question, therefore I have no obligation to answer it. And then so anything I give after that is, you can't take it for being a bona fide truth.
Apparently, had your second motion regarding the new trial. There was an objection about the witness testifying about what she was told to say or not say using attorney-client privilege. Was that a valid objection that the defense made at that time?
No, we don't believe that that was a valid objection. The attorney that was present was representing Harris and the interests of Harris. This employee was a utility marble porter, but at the lowest level of the hierarchy of Harris. She was not being represented by Harris. Harris had an attorney there to represent Harris.
They're alleging that a number of discovery errors in this case, and to me, they can be broken down conceptually into two types of errors, right? One is with the gun control frame, right? There's allegations of discovery abuse that you couldn't have known of until after the trial because you found out in the criminal case. That's essentially what the general flight testimony is. But some of your arguments are allegations of discovery abuse that are facially bad. You look at the interrogatory, you know it's not responsive, okay? So with regard to that category, if it's facially bad, maybe you look at it. It's a bunch of questions and a bunch of non-responsive answers. Why didn't you do something with that at the time by filing a motion with the conservatorship? But the ones you couldn't have known are because they're concealed and you didn't find out later, that's a different thing. But the ones that you're alleging are facially so bad that you just look at it and it's not responsive. You have, I mean, you said multiple avenues, but you know, why didn't you pursue those?
I would argue that the answer was not facially bad. Let me read the interrogatory. This is interrogatory number 19. Describe what you or your company did to implement customer safety at defendant's premises. In particular, to those utilizing the floors, walkways, in the subject area where plaintiff fell. Objection. This interrogatory is vague and overly broad. Subject to said objections, Harris states as follows. Porters would inspect the premises, including the floors, for any hazards, and would facilitate removal of safety hazards from the premises. As discovery is continuing, Harris reserves the right to supplement his answer to this interrogatory. I think that the interrogatory itself is clear on its face. It's not vague and ambiguous. And essentially, Harris then told us what they did. They have a safety program. They have people that constantly walk the casino to look for spills. When we find a spill, we cordon it off. We make sure that nobody walks through it. And we clean it up. That was, we thought, a reasonable answer. We didn't realize that we needed to go beyond that and ask for more. This is buttressed by the fact that we also noticed the person most knowledgeable suspected.
This is the first moment of that question. When you get to the kill Frank and following up on Chief Judge Gibbons' question, you have this guy, Chief Joe Frank, and you're alleging that it's almost a crossover between those two conceptual categories, I just described. She's deciding that she withheld testimony during the first trial because she felt pressure to admit it, and you didn't know that until later. But when you were inquiring about that in the deposition, you got what you alleged to be bad attorney client privilege objections. Now, you're telling me that those objections were bad on their face because she that wasn't her attorney. Why didn't you do something with those objections? Regardless of the underlying information whether she was committed at that moment, why didn't you do something about those allegedly bad objections?
Your Honor, that's a mistake that was made by both the district court judge and by opposing parties. Sweet was not the party to that deposition. That was a deposition that was taken in the Wild case.
I have a question on that with Carol Frank. She makes this broad statement saying something like, well, if the other employee didn't take so many breaks, Sweet would have fallen. How, under what rule would you get this in at trial, even if we were to reverse? How would you ever get that statement in? Speculative, irrelevant opinion.
We don't know exactly what Carol Frank would have said had she been deposed by our office. Attorney for Ron was not really concerned with what Carol Frank did or did not do in the Sweet case. He asked some general questions. One of the points that the trial court made was that, Ms. Frank testified that she told the truth, that she answered all the questions. It's our position that a witness feels intimidated and feels like someone's asking her to not tell the truth, that she's going to bend over backwards and try to evaluate her own testimony in a light most favorable to her to determine whether or not she told the truth.
So she said she told the truth. And she answered everything that was asked of her. So how could that be a fraud in the court? That's your typical pre-trial. You know, any trial lawyer, only answer what's asked of you and tell the truth. And that's what she said she did. So how do you come up with fraud upon the court?
As The problem is that we don't know what the actual statement that was made to her was. And that is the key to our argument, is that without knowing what that actual statement was, what the circumstances of that statement were, we can't really decide without a lot of speculation.
Let's hypothetically say that the attorney threatened to withdraw and said, we're going to fire you. At the end of the day, she still told the truth and answered what was asked for by the attorneys. How do you then parlay that into fraud upon the court?
Well, basically what we're saying is that when an attorney intends to intimidate a witness with the intent to influence testimony, that is a criminal violation of an Article 199.240.
Do you contact the DA?
We think that at this point, without the testimony of Carol Frank as to what was said, it's difficult to contact the district attorney.
Having a hearing on that, it's more detailed than
that's what we asked the court to do. We asked the court to either have a hearing in open court to examine Ms. Frank, or to order another deposition where we would be able to take the deposition. And we're, in fact, today going to ask this court the relief we're requesting, because it's a matter of remanding to the district court so that this testimony can be heard. But to answer your question, Judge Silver, we think that when there is a prima facie case, then it's turning on the opposing side, violated the law, this goes to the very integrity of the judicial process, and it impugns the proceedings in our case. And we think that allegation alone is sufficient to warrant further inquiry before we make a final decision in this matter.
So let me just be clear, the relief you're asking for is
I did say three minutes in my this. Okay, thank you.
Judge Gibbons and Associate Judges Michael Wall here on behalf of Harris, and we thank you for this opportunity to address the court. I'd like to jump right into the tail that is wagging this dog, which is the very, very late motion for 60B relief, which is the what we had so much discussion about. That motion for 60B relief is jurisdictionally barred except for one issue, and that is the issue of fraud on the court. And we haven't seen anything that has been pleaded or discussed that even comes close to the level that you need to have for a fraud that is on the court. This isn't just an amazing discovery techniques, or they lied, or we think that some of the evidence that was presented wasn't appropriate. If we look at what they're talking about, throughout our brief on the second appeal on the 60B motion, Harris, in this case, in the Sweet case, is constantly accused of actions that took place in the wrong case. Because, hey, it's still Harris. Harris is being sued in that case, Harris is being sued in this case, so Harris, in this case, must have done something wrong in both cases. That kind of argument, even if you accept as gospel truth every single allegation that has been made, it simply doesn't rise to the level of a fraud on the court. And the reliance multiple times throughout the brief on the Pumphrey case is absurd and laughable. In that case, there was a scheme to defraud the court, which was used in multiple cases. It was a scheme that lawyers who were clients and lawyers who were lawyers were aware of, and perpetrated upon the court, and the court said that was a fraud upon the court. And what we have coming from that, from opposing counsel, is, hey, there was some discovery in that case that was evasive, and that was a fraud on the court, and that's how they want to get to this court's jurisdiction. Was the privilege objection appropriate? Probably not. from ever arguing was.
And, well, this is what so. Well, if these people are asking for at least an argument today, whether or not they're entitled to a new trial, they at least want an evidentiary and put Carol Frank on the stand and find out what she would have said that she was not allowed to say because the boyfriend now conceded to be the bank to reply, please, after the objections. What's wrong with at least getting information? What would your answer have been but for those objections?
Well, we could pretty much look at the record and know what her answer would have been. At some point, it wasn't when she was being prepared for discovery. It was when she was in the hallway and there were people there. The lawyer said something that frightened her. It wasn't something said directly to her. That's her testimony. We don't know exactly what it was that she said, but we know from what we have that she was told not to volunteer. And she said, I told the truth. The question wasn't asked, and I would have volunteered had the question been asked. So there's no harm there.
Well, the witness examination statute is interesting. It doesn't, it comes into play and against criminal statute. It's, I'm not sure it applies directly, but to the extent that it is an analogy, right? It prevents an intimidation that results in a witness not only giving false testimony, but in giving incomplete testimony.
And that would be great if we were here and we were charging somebody with witness intimidation and we had to decide whether or not a crime had been committed. And I could not believe that when I pointed that out in my answering brief, that they were accusing us, the attorneys from Hutchinson and Seven, of criminal activity, that they didn't back down on that. Instead, they upped the ante and they said a crime has been committed and we should have a preliminary hearing. We're in a civil hearing here. That has nothing to do with the crime. And even if that's true, even if we analogize that to this case, it came up months later in the context of a deposition, testimony, and then we have this brought. A fraud on the court, many, many months after his otherwise jurisdictionally barred, and even if it's true, whatever she said, we can assume what she said was, well, put the fear of God in her that she was told not to speculate because that's what she was worried about. What was she going to speculate? We know what she's going to speculate. She was going to speculate that Joseph Romano did too many breaks. How do you get that in? It doesn't come in. There's no fraud on the court here. But they didn't ask. It looks great in a brief to say, we didn't get to talk to her. We didn't get to find out exactly what was said. And unfortunately, it's very fortunate. I don't know. We didn't answer that one question that were exactly what was said. But that's not what they asked for in district court. In district court, they wanted to retry the case. They wanted to open up the entire case on B2 and B3. They wanted to have an evidentiary hearing. They proposed 8 witnesses, and they wanted to depose all of these 8 witnesses. And that's what the district court said. I'm not going to allow that. See, this is an issue. See, it's easy to make an issue after the fact. That's what they're doing with the discovery. They're saying, this question that didn't say anything about floors or how do you treat your floors or anything like that, the answer is evasive, and yet they didn't think it was evasive then, and they can't give you a record on which to judge this, because the reason that the answer was complete, the answer said this is what they asked. The question was raised about procedures and policies, and we told them what our procedures and policies were. We had no idea that they were going to make the floor thing the issue in the case. What you don't have in front of you is their opening argument. Counsel decided not to give that to you. That's where the issue gets raised. Then he says, oh, the issue of B2 is not raised until our opening argument, and it was a big surprise. He didn't object because it wasn't a big surprise. What was a big surprise was that he wasn't allowed to ambush us during the trial with the MSDS sheet. That was the big surprise.
I might ask, Mr. Rowe, if you can point to this court where in all of the instructions the jury was actually instructed that Harris, that they were there really to determine whether or not Harris had actual or constructive notice of a spill by a third party. And Sprague is still good law. Why would you have objected to that? And where would they have been instructed other than that?
Again,
all the jury instructions.
Again, they didn't provide us with a record for Your Honor to be able to review this one. And they say, I still
objected to your instruction number 28 saying it was incomplete. So it's
they just said, when that instruction was read, came up, they said, we object to that. They didn't even give a reason for objecting to that. And the Supreme Court has consistently said that's not good enough. And so the response is, because we don't think that was their objection to it.
Have you read the Manning case that came out a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
This is, the district court has a duty to make that part of the record?
The district court should be making it part of the record, but it has always been, and it still is. And even with that case, the parties have a duty to make a record, and they didn't make the record. They didn't put this on the record. Instead, we don't know what was discussed or what the reason for the objection was, but Instruction 28 didn't stand on its own. Instruction 27 goes through and does all of the elements. And if you read Instruction 28 and 27 together, you've got straight. And there were general instructions on negligence.
What instruction, though, point in record, what instruction asked the jury to determine whether or not Harris was on actual constructive notice of third spills by a third party for substances? Because I wonder.
I can't do that because that issue wasn't raised and I didn't look for that specific instruction. The constructive notice issue has, again, raised through the back door. Was never raised in challenge. Yes, the challenge that was raised is that this wasn't complete because it didn't say that they could be held liable if they had some negligence. On the constructive issue, they argue that we had constructive knowledge of spills because of a spill in the future. Because there might be a spill in the future, we have constructive knowledge of all spills. There is no evidence in this case whatsoever that constructive knowledge was even an issue, and again, they don't have a complete record. But constructive knowledge, the argument that they've made in the brief is that because there can be a spill, because you can't prevent any spill, that there might be a spill in the future. I have constructive knowledge of spills in the future. That's absurd. That's not the law. The law doesn't require a landowner to know about a condition that may exist in the future. If there have been spills, a landowner has to take reasonable precautions based on that. But I don't have constructive knowledge of this particular spill, which, by the way, was quite large, and she didn't see it, and she slipped in it. And even though open and obvious is not a defense, open and obvious is a part of the analysis of whether or not there's comparative fault. And that's what the jury was told. That's how the arguments were. From the beginning, the fourth thing wasn't the big issue for the defense for Harris. Harris's defense was, we acted reasonably as a landowner. That's what we're supposed to do. We have all these things in place. We inspect. We have this program. We get incentives. If there's a spill, we immediately pour in the job. No matter who that employee is, they don't leave. We acted in all respects in good faith. And as a landowner, and reasonably, not strict liability, but the standard of a reasonable landowner. That was our defense. And then, in the opening argument of opposing counsel, it turns into, did you or did you not put something on your floor that would make it less sub-resistant? Well, we did put something on the floor, as a matter of fact. In our initial disclosures before the first request went out, we told them exactly what we put on the floor. And when they sent out their request for production of documents, which was the only thing they addressed that, we identified that and directed them to those documents. We did put that on the floor. They didn't investigate. They didn't. And then the first thing they say in open argument is that they didn't put anything on their floor that would make it slip resistant. So again, we didn't put on V2 and we put on V3. And by the way, all of the testimony, there was testimony both ways on this. It was Carol Frank testified that she never used V3. She also testified that she used V3 at a time when she wasn't even employed in field care. She also testified to a number of other things that were inconsistent. But the other witnesses they testified that it was used. The amount, the only thing that they come up with on the amount is something from the Ron case that we never had a chance to even be a part of, which they say conclusively proves that we never ever bought V3. Well, a couple of things on that. Number one, we don't keep records of every roll of toilet paper that we buy. And we didn't get to see those records and see exactly what they are. They don't even cover the right period of time. A single bottle of V3 lasts for a very, very long time because you use a tiny, tiny amount of that. It's not like the V2, which you put on the whole service, but we didn't get a chance to put on an expert to address all of these issues because it wasn't an issue in our case, and that has been backed over into us.
But back to the basic point on a circuit court case instruction is given to the jury. Instruction number 28 is not
it's a botchy instruction instead of a pattern. Just out of sheer curiosity, we have several pattern jury instructions.
I wasn't there. We don't have the record of how that was settled, and I don't know what the other ones are because this isn't the issue that they raised. They raised the issue that this instruction 28, in and of itself, did not tell the jury that Harris would be found responsible and liable if they had their own negligence. And my response to that is, Instruction 27 says that, and if you read it 27 and 28 together, they cover every element there is in Sprague. And if you put those together with the rest of the instructions, then the jury was properly instructed. They were instructed that if Harris was negative, that was what the whole case was about. And the jury understood what the case was about. They
didn't talk about foreign substances.
I'm sorry?
The jury didn't talk about foreign substances.
He talked about general liability as
the landowner liability. He didn't talk about
the landowner. The 28 talked about that land is also general. The landowner isn't responsible for, is not an insurer of the people who come there, and that's a correct statement of the law.
But isn't the district court really the real entity to oversee that the jury is instructed in all aspects of the case?
Yes, that's completely true. And if the instructions are incorrect in some material manner that was raised, that issue is preserved for appeal. But in this case, that's not what we have. What we have is a challenge to number 28 because it doesn't have one sentence in it. That's what they wanted it to have. Even in their reply brief, they said this should have had this partial sentence at the end, and that partial sentence is covered by number 27. And if you look at all of the instructions as a whole, they properly instruct on the case, and that issue hasn't been raised. So I haven't come back in my brief and gone through the other instructions to show whether they support it, because it wasn't raised. Nobody has ever argued that the instructions as a whole are incorrect and didn't have the right standards in them. They did have the right standards in them. And as a whole, they are correct. And that instruction, that 28 has been used many, many times, that last phrase that's there doesn't make it incorrect or incomplete. It's a correct statement of the law, and if they wanted a different statement of the law, they can propose it. And there's no indication that they did or didn't do that. We don't even have a record on that point. The instruction that's given was a proper instruction. I didn't get to get to all of the other things because my time is up. But this is simply an attack on a jury verdict, and that verdict is supported by the evidence.
Object to Mr. Wall's criticism of the records. We sent a letter to opposing counsel, asked them, what do you want to put in the joint appendix? And we received a reply, we're not going to do a joint appendix, we'll do our own. So anything that Mr. Wall wanted in the appendix, his co-counsel said we're going to put it in our own. For us to criticize us on the appendix is unreasonable. Talk about this motion for judgment to be reversed based on fraud on the court being very late. There is no time limit on a judgment to be reversed for fraud on the court. In fact, Ms. Frank was within 4 months of retirement. One of the things we did was wait for her to retire before we filed the motion because we didn't want to get her any further trouble. There was a huge objection. Unfortunately, our counsel decided that we didn't want to embarrass the judge and prejudice the judge against us by recording this sidebar conference on Instruction 28. So, Instruction 28 had copious argument back and forth in the sidebar time.
Actually, it's up to trial counsel to make that record. And when you look at the table of instructions, there's an objection. That's when you make your record.
Yes, we acknowledge that. As far as the open and obvious, the entire system is put forward by Harris and family. Resolve still shows it still not open and obvious. They immediately block them off. They immediately put chairs over them. They immediately put cones up. If these were really open and obvious, none of that would be